Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/powersafely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and well, hey, I guess I want to say hey and welcome to the podcast, but this is a little different because this is the intro to the podcast.
That's right. We recorded a live episode at the LA Podcast Festival.
Right.
And this is it.
Yeah, this is it. We did one on Rodney Dangerfield. It was September 19th, 2015, mm-hmm. The Sofitel in Beverly Hills. Very chic.
Very chic.
And it was a lot of fun.
So agreed.
We hope you guys have fun listening to it.
And stick around after the credits roll, so to speak, because we have a little bonus track at the end of this one.
How are you guys doing? Thank you very much for coming to our show. We do this normally, but it's usually just two of us and Jerry sitting here on Facebook while we record.
Like eating miso soup.
Yep. She loves miso soup. And then, you know, we do live shows too, but normally there's like a gulf of a stage between us and like, you guys are right here. So we're watching you too, I guess is what I'm saying.
She's got on one of our shirts.
Nice. Nice shirt.
And she's the only one. Oh, I like that. Of course they are. It says I listen to podcasts before cereal.
Burned.
Yeah. And on the back it says, "But I love cereal."
Right. We should also say hi to everybody in live stream.
Oh yeah, streaming folks, hello, and of course thanks to Audible and Squarespace and the rest of those people don't sponsor us, so I don't feel like
right.
I didn't mention anything.
Yeah. Does that count as a mid-roll ad?
Sure.
Okay, cool.
There's a guy with a sack of money waiting outside the door right now.
Mr. Monopoly is just hanging out outside. Okay, so what you got anything to start with?
I got nothing to start with. I usually don't drink this early in the day, but calm the nerves and is felt it would be fitting. As a tribute to our topic, which we're going to get into. So I decided to work up a heavy sweat.
Right.
Because Rodney Dangerfield was known for drinking and sweating.
Yeah. You're so basically just missing the tie. It yeah. got everything else covered.
Thanks.
Are you guys familiar with one Mr. Rodney Dangerfield?
Yeah.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that. He's an increasingly underappreciated comedian. Like I've talked to at least a couple people who have not seen Back to School.
Oh,
I know.
Right?
Boo. Hiss.
And I was actually talking to someone who works here at the festival who said, is he dead? And I said, yeah.
That happens a lot to that
and
guy.
And she said, why don't I remember that? And I went, it's no respect.
No respect. That's the cool thing about the guy. Like that was his whole shtick. That was his whole hook, right?
Well, we need to start in the traditional way, don't you?
Oh, okay. All right. You ready?
Oh, very nice.
Thank you. Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuckers Bryant, and we are here at LA Podfest. And all you lovely people, give yourselves a hand. Thank you. Is that better? You feel
yeah.
a little more? You
right,
guys
right
happy with that too? Good. Okay. Well, now we have to start over. How many people have seen Back to School? Great start. So as we were saying, the weird thing about Rodney Dangerfield is that, his whole shtick about no respect was actually really, really close to accurate, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And not just while he was growing up. He had a really tragic, terrible childhood. But also as he got older and older, and even after he blew up, he still, people just kind of took what he was saying and ran with it. Like he had this one story where he opened a club, which we'll talk about, called Dangerfields. So it's very obviously his club. And he was on his way up to the stage. He'd just been like called up there. And on his way, some guy stops him and says, "Rodney, can I have your autograph? And can you also give me some more butter?" And like this happened to this guy quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it does turn out that you will see, even after death, the guy got no respect. But as Chuck will assert later, I predict, he's a comedian's comedian and very actually well respected by the ones that count.
Sure. And I don't know if you guys know this, but a lot of comedians have inner pain, which is the reason a lot of them get into comedy and a reason that many of them drink till they black out on many nights. Inner pain is no secret to the comedy world, but you'd be hard pressed to find someone who was as legitimately depressed and sad as Rodney Dangerfield.
He was like a crying clown for real.
He was. He often talked about the heaviness he felt every day when he woke up. He said he would wake up and every day and there it was lingering above him was his heaviness.
With a capital H even.
Yeah. And if you ever want to go down a YouTube rat hole, just look up some interviews with the guy on YouTube from like the 80s. And, you know, he does a lot of interviews with just like local TV stations promoting movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. And when he's out of his shtick element, it's one of the saddest things you've ever seen, man. It's really depressing. He just had this air about him. You could tell he had the weight of life on his shoulders, and it all pretty much stems from his awful, awful, awful childhood.
Right. His childhood. Isn't this hilarious so far, everybody? So we should start at the beginning with him. He was born in 1921 on Long Island.
Yeah.
Not in Long Island, Chuck tells me. He was born to a vaudevillian father who took off with one of Rodney's brothers to go hit the circuit. And that was that. Like I think he saw him like once or twice a year for a half hour, an hour, something like that.
Yeah, he said he saw his dad literally like twice a year growing up. And, he was born Jacob Cohen. And his dad was a juggler and a comic who, apparently hit the road because of his wife, who was, you know, we were talking about what an awful person she was when we were going over this stuff.
Right.
And that she was, but the more I thought about it, she had a serious problem. It was, you know, back in the 1920s, you didn't diagnose things like they do today.
Right. But, you just ran off to the vaudeville circuit.
Pretty much. But she was clearly depressed, like profoundly depressed. And, sadly, completely abandoned emotionally and neglected, little Jacob. He was left on his own from the time he could remember. His mom literally never hugged him once, never kissed him once.
He swore up and down.
Yeah.
This, yeah.
And never complimented him, or like tried to build him up. She was a bad lady.
And starting probably around age 8 or something like that, he realized that if he was going to eat dinner on a regular basis, he was going to have to go get a job and go grocery shopping himself, right? So he basically raised himself starting about age 8 or so.
Yeah.
Speaking of groceries, one of the great things that stuck out to him about his childhood, he was he had to get a job, and after school job, he was still in school. And he lived in a fairly wealthy neighborhood, but he was not wealthy. So he used to deliver groceries to his classmates' homes.
Yeah.
Which is kind of demoralizing when you're like 10, you know? And he also, while he was out there running around on the streets, he wrote an autobiography the year he died in 2004. And, he called this chapter Male Prostitute.
Yeah.
Because he was like 10 and he was so unsupervised that there were apparently at least one or two local molesters that were like, "Hey, Rodney, come on up. I got a nickel for you."
Yeah.
And he swears up and down that it was just, it was just kissing everybody. Don't worry. The child was just kissed by the grown man for a nickel. But it happened a lot, and he was doing it because he needed the money.
Yeah.
So anyway, Rodney Dangerfield. Let's fast forward out of this horrible, horrible funk.
And by the way, we're going to pepper in some of his best jokes here and there. And I debated on whether or not to try and do it as him because it's hard.
I've already promised certain people here or there.
It's hard to do that. It's hard to tell a Rodney Dangerfield joke without kind of doing him. And I took a little informal poll last night with some folks and they're like, yeah, you sort of have to.
Yeah, I think so.
It's not like it's a good impression, but.
Plus, it makes me delivering it my flat weirdo affect where I'm not even trying it all the weirder. So prepare for that, too.
But one thing that he did and that, of course, a lot of comics do is they turn that pain into funny. And he really relied on his jokes as a way to the only time he was happy was when he was on stage performing. And as soon as he left, that heaviness would come back. But he often joked about his mom. He would say, my mom never breastfed me. She told me she always thought of me as a friend.
That's a good one.
Which is a funny joke, but when you know the real pain behind it, it's just like the saddest thing you've ever heard.
It takes a tad bit of the funniness away from it. I've got a good parent one. You ready?
Yeah.
So I remember the time, and this is my Rodney Dangerfield. I remember the time I was kidnapped. They sent a piece of my finger to my father. He said he wanted more proof. That probably did not happen, but it gets the point across, you know? And plus, it's funny. And so if you're
I got
in...
one more parent joke.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I tell you, my parents hated me. My bath toys were a toaster and a radio.
Funny.
All right, that's going over better than I thought it would.
So starting about age 15, he realizes he's actually kind of hilarious and that he has a talent for taking all of this horrible, tragic stuff and turning it into funny stuff. He started writing jokes and he got good pretty quick. He started selling jokes age 15 or 16 to establish comedians, right?
Yeah. And he kept them. He had this duffel bag. He would write jokes by hand his entire career and put them in this duffel bag. So he literally had a duffel bag full of like thousands and thousands of jokes. Mm-hmm. And apparently I think, you said that during a typical performance later, like once he hit the big time, he would tell like over 300 jokes in a set.
Like 350.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. In an hour.
And granted, they're quick jokes, but right. Still, it's
yeah.
Amazing.
But he remembered them all and he knew which ones fit best. Like the guy was a comic genius. Hopefully that's coming across here or will by the end of this, right? So he gets his big break at age 19. He's written jokes for a few years and he's going to try this out. And he gets a job at a Catskills resort for $12 a week.
Yeah.
10 weeks, including room and board.
Yeah, think Dirty Dancing, that kind of scene.
Very much so, yeah. But he's like the up-and-coming comic on stage, right? Have you guys ever seen Iron Man meets Dirty Dancing, that mashup? No? Go check it out, actually. It is so bizarre. It's one of the better things you'll ever see. That has nothing to do with Rodney Dangerfield. That was just an add-on, basically. But so he's working. He's working hard. The stint in the Catskills, like, I don't think he gets re-upped, but he keeps going back to the Catskills. It's one of his regular gigs. But on the side, while he's working, he's a singing waiter at the Polish Falcons nightclub where Lenny Bruce's mom was the MC. He was an acrobatic diver.
Right. But I know what you're all thinking. Triple Lindy. No, he did not do the Triple Lindy in the movie, obviously.
And for those of you who have not seen Back to School, that was an in-joke.
Yeah. He was a diver in the movie, a competitive diver.
Yeah. Well, I was going to punish them for not having seen it.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I was trying to drive home a point.
So in 1951, he gets married for the first time to a jazz singer named Joyce Indig. And he had a couple of kids and moved to New Jersey, which we all know is the death knell for any comedian trying to work in New York. Kind of means you've given up. But he didn't give up just yet.
He did for a minute, sure.
Yeah, not at that point, though. He was still trying to work. But when he turned 27, he quit comedy and literally did not perform from the age of 28 to 41. And at 41, he was like, let's try this again.
Right. Well, he and his wife divorced. So he's like, I've got a little more time. I think I'm going to go try comedy again. And they actually got back together like the next year and stayed married for another 10 years or something like that. But this time around, he was like, let me see if I can figure out how to balance home life with this. I'm trying to break into comedy. Right.
Yeah. And let me try and develop an act. I think the first time he floundered because he didn't know what kind of comedian he wanted to be. He tried singing. He tried impressions. He even tried prop comedy for a little while.
But he also, I mean, and he had these jokes about how much his life sucked. Like, he used some of these same jokes his whole life, but they just didn't hang on him quite right because he had his whole life ahead of him, and he was young and full of promise. That second time around, he was right there in the sweet spot, like age 41-ish, a little desperate, kind of sweaty, and these jokes about how bad his life... These jokes about how bad his life was or where it was going, like really just kind of hit a lot more. He adopted a persona basically. And, yeah. it that definitely helped.
Yeah. I mean, it was sort of him, but it was also a character. And when I was researching this, I was kind of thinking about you don't see a lot of character comedians anymore.
No.
Like that was the sort of the heyday with like Andrew Dice Clay and Rodney Dangerfield and Emo Phillips, and it seemed like there were a lot of characters, but now it's just like, look at this thing that happened in my life and how funny it is. Look at all these witty observations.
Chuck Travolta.
About my life. I'd like to see some good character comedians come back.
Yeah, I can't think of a single
one. Are there any out there? I guess Brent Weinbach, that's kind of a character.
Oh, wait,
right?
Wait. What about like Larry the Cable Guy? He's total. I assume he's a character.
No, that
right?
is a character because he started out as a completely different kind of comedian.
Oh, yeah.
And then adopted that persona.
Yeah.
But I don't count him as a comedian, so. He's not watching, don't worry.
No, he's not.
He's writing bad jokes.
I'm going to start a flame war with Larry the Cable Guy.
I'll totally take him up on that flame war. Although he could squash me with his sacks of money. So he adopts his character. He changes his name legally, at this point to Jack Roy, which was that his father's name?
His father's stage name was Phil Roy.
Yeah. And so he changed his name legally to Jack Roy, and that was his real name till the day he died. And he was performing under that name for a while until he tried this second go and decided, I don't want anyone to remember Jack Roy. So, he told this guy that was booking him at a club in Manhattan, could you just make up a name for me and put that on the, well, I guess it wouldn't a marquee, but on the playbill.
Yeah. Or, you know, in any ad they took out.
Yeah.
So the guy, who ran this place, the Inwood Lounge, I think, came up with Rodney Dangerfield, right? But the weird thing is, he had actually lifted the name from a Jack Benny character. Like there was an original Rodney Dangerfield and it wasn't Rodney Dangerfield, right?
Isn't that weird?
The giant twist of the podcast. It's all downhill from here. So the Jack Benny came up with this character in I think the 40s maybe or something like that.
Yeah.
Of this grade Z Western hero named Rodney Dangerfield. And I guess the lounge owner remembered it and came up with that. Rodney Dangerfield had no idea about this. So he's walking around like using this name for years.
Yeah.
And apparently he met Johnny Carson once at one of his shows and Johnny Carson was like, you know where your name came from, right?
And he said, no, I don't.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, he explained the whole Jack Benny thing. And later on, he saw Jack Benny, and Jack Benny wasn't like mad or anything. He actually said, I really love what you did with the character, and you really, you know, you did it just right. So no harm, no foul.
Yeah. And they hugged it out from that very famously.
So on the second go-round, he was making a living, doing okay. But he got his real big break in 1967, with Ed Sullivan. He was, he couldn't get booked on Ed Sullivan, but at the time they would book other comedians for the run-throughs as like just placeholders for dress rehearsal, basically. And so he got a spot booked on that and apparently did so well in dress rehearsal that Ed Sullivan, you know, took note on the side of the stage, which means he went like this. You know, you're funny.
Right.
That was how you knew Ed Sullivan thought you were funny, as if he just told you.
Bring
that.
Him to me.
That, hey, that's
thank
pretty
you,
good.
Thanks, guys. It works for Nixon, too. You can do that.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Nixon. So, and actually, that was the result of a huge long shot. He told his agent, like, just get me on Ed Sullivan. And it panned out very well. He ended up being on Ed Sullivan, like, 17 times or something like that. And it led to all these other, late night appearances. He was on Carson, like, I think a record. He holds the record for being on Carson the most. 70 times, something like that.
Yeah.
Merv Griffin, Dino, like all the dudes who were running late night and basically were the tastemakers for all of the comedians were suddenly promoting the sweaty, weird, coked up, pothead booze hound.
Huge pothead,
named,
by the way.
Rodney Dangerfield, right? And he took it and ran with it. Like, right when he hit in 1967, he got to work like that.
He was such a big pothead, actually. The original name of his biography was going to be My Love Affair with Marijuana.
Yeah.
And he was serious. He wanted to call it that because he smoked pot, he said, for, you know, 60-something years. But, well, up until the day he died, literally.
Yeah, I think from, like, 21 on.
Like, he was smoking pot in ICU in the hospital because he had an early medical marijuana exemption long before anyone even knew what that was.
Like, he just wrote his own. No one even knew what that was. But if he flashed it in your face, you didn't ask questions.
So he got his big break. Actually, Carson had blackballed him for a while because he accused Carson in a letter of stealing, or one of his writers, of stealing one of his jokes. So Carson famously wouldn't have him on the show for a long time until they eventually, right? Until they eventually met and worked it out. And then Johnny became like the biggest fan ever. And if you want to enjoy yourself at home on the YouTubes, just go look up Johnny Carson on Rodney, or Rodney Dangerfield on Carson. And there's a lot of clips where, I mean, Carson was just like the ultimate setup dude. And like, just let him do his thing.
Yeah, and he would laugh until he was crying.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Because he couldn't believe that Dangerfield was getting away with saying most of the stuff he was saying on TV, on Carson's own show. It was good.
So he's married, he's working a lot, and he decides that he doesn't want to happen to his own kids what happened to him, which was to be neglected. So he said, you know what I'm going to do, even though no one's ever done this, I'm going to borrow a bunch of money.
$250,000.
And I'm going to open my own comedy club in New York City so I can stay home with my children, Brian and Melanie, I think.
Right. And it's not like he had any money right then, you know? Like, this is a huge, huge risk for him.
Yeah, he was doing okay, but he had to borrow all
that. Not that okay, right? Yeah. So everybody tries to talk him out of it. He goes ahead with it, and it's such a success. He has the loan paid off in like 18 months. Just a huge success. And this club actually became venerable in its own right.
Yeah, it's still there today, right? Dangerfield's in New York.
Yep, and it had this HBO special that it broadcast out of in a bunch of comedians got their big breaks on that show, like Seinfeld, Chris Rock, I think.
Yeah, Jim Carrey, what's his face, Saget.
Jeff Foxworthy.
Yeah.
A lot of Jeff Foxworthy fans in the room.
Rita Rudner. Of course, Sam Kinison. He completely made Sam Kinison's career. Yeah. And that was what he – and that's why comedians love him so much, because it meant more to him to play father to these young comics and to give them their start than almost anything else. He really – that was sort of his life's goal, was to seek out talent that he thought was original and really kind of boost them up.
He was a huge Freudian.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole father-son thing. And yeah.
I wonder why.
Yeah. So, Chuck, where are we at?
We are at Dangerfield's. It is 1980, and he decides that, you know what, I should start making movies. Because, well, he made a few movies before that, but nothing that anyone would know. He was actually cast first by Stanley Kubrick in 1956 for the movie...
The Killer?
Yeah, The Killing.
The Killing.
Great movie. Who said yeah? Wow. Yeah, great movie. So he plays Onlooker. big part. And then he was in another movie. What was that other one called? The Projectionist?
Yeah, it was a big part in a very small movie. He said that it was the type of movie where they went to go shoot on location by taking the subway.
Which is probably true.
Yeah, I think it was. But he played this movie projectionist boss, and the projectionist had quite an imagination, and he was a superhero, and Dangerfield was this arch villain nemesis. It didn't go very far. But.
No.
He learned almost nothing about how to shoot a movie, because this was 77, and apparently his huge, huge breakthrough came in Caddyshack, right? He was already very much a well-respected comedian, but when he shot Caddyshack, Harold Ramis, right?
Yeah.
When he directed it, he said later on that clearly Dangerfield didn't know what he was doing. He was a live performer, so when Harold Ramis said action, Rodney Dangerfield would just stand there and be like, you want me to do my bit now? You're like, yeah, that's what action means, right?
Do your bit.
And so then Rodney would just turn to the camera and like do his whole bit into the camera. He's like, well, hold on, we gotta get this right here. So pretend the camera's not there, one. And he finally got him to do it, because that was the thing that just broke him out.
Yeah, and he hated making movies. Like you said, he loved performing live in front of people, and that's where he got his rush. And he once compared making movies to, he said, like, you know, when you make a kid write something 100 times on the chalkboard and they've done something wrong, he's like, that's what making a movie is like. He hated doing all these takes. He hated standing around and waiting. Plus, which is why he didn't make a ton of movies.
He felt like the live audience is like, he compared it to a heroin addict, like shooting up, you know, like he just loved that rush. And, he definitely didn't get that from movies, which, I mean, you got like the crew standing around looking at you, waiting for lunch, you know, it wasn't his bag at all.
It was not his bag. You found this, description from Rolling Stone editor Ben Fong Torres, which I think describes him, like to a T. Do you want to read that, sir?
Okay. So Ben Fong Torres, who is in Almost Famous, he had a quote. He says, Rodney Dangerfield looks like a midlife crisis. There's a surface orderliness. He's groomed and he's dressed like a businessman at a convention. Gray hair slicked back over a haggard shades of Mayor Daley face. Dark suit, white shirt, bright red tie, silk stockings, shiny shoes. But the neatness gives way to what he calls the heaviness that looms over him. Life gives Rodney Dangerfield the jitters. He's in a constant sweat. He wipes his brow incessantly, tugs at his tie, herky-jerky. As he recounts the horrors of his daily life, he shifts his shoulders uncomfortably, and his eyes bug out of their bags. He moves the floor mic around as he roams the Comedy Store stage, looking for sympathy, but all he gets are laughs. I just think that's fantastic, man. He nailed Rodney Dangerfield in that.
Absolutely. And his shirt and tie, that came about because, well, he hated clothes and fashion.
Yeah.
Let's just go ahead and say that.
I think it's time.
He was a slob. He was a slob. He said in interviews how much he hated clothes, how he never cared about clothes and fashion and was comfortable in a robe, basically.
Yeah.
And, but for one of his first acts, he put on the red tie and the black suit and like dressed all dapper. And when it came, for the second performance, he was like, well, they liked me in that, so I'm just going to wear that. And that became his shtick was, you know, this very dapper looking guy who's always very well put together.
Right.
In fact, I just saw earlier today, when he gave out a best makeup award at the, I think, 87 Academy Awards.
Really?
Yeah. And he walked up and he said, hey, nice tuxedo, everybody, right? And he went, underneath, torn undershorts. And you get this feeling that, like, that was the dead truth.
Yeah, I'm sure.
He probably had, like, holy underwear on underneath
I'm
that
quite
tux.
Sure, yeah.
You should look that up too, man. That's a great.
I will.
Because he basically does 5 minutes of stand-up at the Academy Awards. Right. And then gives out an award.
So Iron Man versus Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, take some notes.
And then some Dangerfield stuff. Should we take a break here, Chuck?
Take an ad break?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll be right back after this. Big announcement, folks. It's called a podcast event called The Message.
That's right. Thanks to GE Podcast Theater and Panoply, there is an 8-part series out right now called The Message, and you can get it wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and you know what? It's going to blow your collective scientific minds because it's currently rocking our worlds.
Yep. So The Message follows the story of Nikki Tomlin, who's a PhD in linguistics, right?
That's right.
At the University of Chicago, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. And she's following a team of cryptologists, which really, if you say cryptology, you've really got me hooked already.
Sure.
They're a research think tank called Cypher. They're trying to decode a message received from outer space from 70 years ago.
Yeah, it's from outer space, we think. And if you're not familiar with the story, well, then I guess you better go listen to The Message. You can get it on iTunes. You can get it on any of your podcast apps. Just go search for The Message and subscribe today.
Yeah, so thanks to GE Podcast Theater and Panoply for pushing the boundaries of the medium. You guys are doing a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Go subscribe to The Message and listen today.
And we're back.
All right. Told you that would work. So he makes Caddyshack, huge hit. He's allowed to kind of just do his thing in that movie. I'm sure most people have seen that classic comedy, which Josh said would stink if it weren't for Rodney Dangerfield
and Bill Murray.
And Bill Murray.
The rest of it, it's like a tepid coming of age dramedy. It sucks.
Ted Knight?
He was fine, but I mean, you can watch Too Close for Comfort and get just as much as you want, you know? I just don't think it needed to be in the movie.
All right.
I think it was Bill Murray and Rodney Dangerfield. That's what made Caddyshack a classic. A
little Chevy Chase.
A tad. You know how I feel about Chevy Chase. My father raised me to hate Chevy Chase.
Did he really?
Yeah, he really did.
Your dad didn't like him?
Oh, man. Still does not like Chevy Chase.
Why? Just he didn't think he's funny, or he thought he was
such
pompous
a
ass?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something about Chevy Chase sticks in my dad's craw. And he passed it on to me. Isn't that weird?
It is totally weird.
Yeah, that's what you get when your dad's not a vaudevillian. They pass on weird stuff like that to you, you know?
So he makes Caddyshack. It was a huge hit. Now he was a legitimate. He was sought after for movies. And then in 1983, he wrote a movie called Easy Money.
Has anybody seen that?
Anyone?
Yeah, it's actually a pretty cool movie.
It's not bad. It's a little weird structurally, which kind of makes sense that he wrote it.
Right.
Because he clearly didn't know how to write a script.
Yeah.
He knew how to write a bunch of good jokes, though. So he played Monty Capuletti, an Italian-American drunk pothead. Baby photographer.
Because this is back in the early 80s when anyone of any ethnicity could play anyone of another ethnicity.
Sure.
Right? Because he was Hungarian born. But yeah. Hey, play an Italian guy. It's cool.
So in the movie, his mother-in-law was the inspiration for Twin Beds and hated her son-in-law. And when she died, she said, all right, you can have all this money if for 1 year, I think like $10 million, mm-hmm. if for 1 year you quit gambling and boozing and smoking and doing drugs. So Easy Money was, you know, had Joe Pesci. It was okay.
Right. Like the first half of this movie is just a series of vignettes to where he just completely screws everything up and like that your stomach's all upset and everything and like you're really emotional and then nothing comes of it whatsoever. Right. And then finally halfway through the plot arrives.
Yeah.
And then it gets kind of good, actually.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. A lot of build-up, not a lot of payoff in that one.
But one Roger Ebert liked the movie, even mm-hmm. though it was a little weird, and said basically the movie was about watching Rodney Dangerfield. He said, Rodney Dangerfield gloriously playing himself as the nearest thing we are likely to get to W.C. Fields in this lifetime.
Right.
And Rodney himself said that it was that was pretty much me on screen. That's as close as you can come to my real life.
In Easy Money.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, he was a baby photographer.
So 1986 is when he finally makes Back to School, which was his biggest hit. I think it cost like $13 million to make.
$11 million.
Yeah. A gross well over $100 million, which in 1986, I mean, today that's still good money.
Yeah, in today dollars, that's $150 billion. It's inflation for you, right?
This one he played, he had the idea, I think he got a story credit of a guy, a father that goes back to school who was a big loser in life. So he goes back to school with his son to get his degree. And he told that idea to Harold Ramis and he was like, that's good. But what if he was rich? What if he was wealthy and had it all and still goes back to school, like knowing what he knows now with a lot of money? And Rodney was like, okay, that's the movie.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
And it actually, I mean, that was a huge movie when it came out. It was the sixth biggest movie of 1986. It was behind Top Gun,
yeah.
Platoon, Karate Kid 2, Star Trek 4, and there's one other one that's written down somewhere in here. But they were big movies, and it was like the sixth highest grossing movie of the year, and it's Rodney Dangerfield, right?
Yeah, and so he has hit it big at this time and is a huge, huge movie star. And the biggest comic, I think they did a survey in the late 70s, right before his movies, with college students that said that they were, Rodney Dangerfield was their favorite comic.
Yeah.
And he was 61 years old?
58.
58 years old.
Same thing, basically.
Was when he hit it big as a comedian. 58 years old.
Right. And like college kids are like into this guy. And actually, if all of you've seen Back to School, if that's all you've seen of Rodney Dangerfield, you don't quite have the understanding of what he was actually like. He was a pretty edgy comic, actually, and pretty hilarious. And college kids loved him in the 70s. He hosted Saturday Night Live in 1980.
Yeah.
When he was, I think, like 60 or something, 59. And he started to blow up like at about age 60.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Should we tell a few more of his favorite jokes?
I think it's high time, don't you guys?
We'll go over a few of these. He has a great joke about, his psychiatrist. I told my psychiatrist that everyone hates me. And he said, I was being ridiculous. Everyone hasn't met me yet. classic.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, I like this one. It's lowbrow, but I like it. You know what class is? When you're alone, you fart, you say, excuse me. That's class. Isn't that weird?
So if you haven't noticed, a lot of his jokes were, they were self-deprecating for himself, but also about his family. He talked about his wife was dumb and fat and his son was stupid. And even when he wasn't, I mean, it was all a character. So even when he wasn't married, he was telling jokes about his wife.
Right, which must have made it a lot easier when he went home at night.
Probably so. But one of my favorite wife jokes was, I tell you, my wife can't cook at all. How can toast have bones?
And your impression is getting better as we go along.
Well, I'm drinking whiskey, so yeah. I'm not saying that.
Brings out the
to do
danger field in all of us. Let's see. I've got one. So like I said, it's a little weird, and I like that in a comic. Just bizarre stuff. He was talking about the bar that he was doing stand up in that night. He says, "What a joint! I asked the bartender for a double, and he brought out a guy who looks like me."
I miss those days, man, where comedians just wrote great jokes, set up punchline over and over.
I
tell you, I drink too much. The last time I went to the doctor, I gave him a urine sample. It had an olive in it.
So great.
So classic.
And then another thing I've learned about Rodney Dangerfield, when you go back and listen to his stuff, he wasn't like mean. He was self-deprecating.
Yeah.
Even when he was targeting like his family, mostly non-existent family, all of it reflected back on him and basically what a loser he was, right? And he didn't have very many mean jokes. He didn't tell like many gay jokes. He didn't tell racist jokes, anything like that. Which, and this is like in the 70s when like everybody was telling horrific jokes like that, right? But he did have this fat joke that stuck out to me. Are you fat? Do you look at a menu and say, okay? I love getting laughs from Rodney Dangerfield's jokes. We should just do this all the time.
I was about to say, I think we have a new act after Stuff You Should Know one day.
Talk about a rush.
I got one more. I'll tell you, I was dating a woman. She called and said, come on over, nobody's home. I went over, nobody was home.
Good stuff.
I have a new career.
Yeah. Reading Rodney Dangerfield jokes.
That's a whole, no one's done that. Cover comedians.
Oh man,
dude.
Sharknado and now this. You're all aware Chuck predicted Sharknado, right? Okay. He did.
You're welcome.
Okay.
No more. You got any more? You like the one about his dog. Tell that one.
Okay. All right. My dog is lazy. He's so lazy he doesn't chase cars. He just lays in the driveway taking down license plates.
All right. So now we're in...
That's enough. Stop laughing.
In the early 1980s, he's making these movies. He won Best Comedy Album Grammy for the album No Respect, beating out Richard Pryor, Monty Python, Gilda Radner, and Father Guido Sarducci. And in 1982, the Smithsonian Institution put his red tie and his shirt in the Smithsonian, the American History, National Museum of American History, right along with Jimmy Durante's hat, Archie Bunker's recliner, mm-hmm. and Charles Lindbergh's plane. But the joke Rodney said was he got a feeling after they left they were just going to use the shirt to wipe down the plane. Right. Always self-deprecating.
Yeah, Andy, and when he handed him the shirt, he said, this is a big deal. I only have two shirts. Which may have been true.
And also in the 1980s, who remembers the Miller Lite commercials from the 1980s? Tastes great, less filling.
That man back there has his hand up. All right.
The best, right?
And a fist pump. He really liked it.
They were great commercials. They were named the eighth best advertising campaign in history, from McCann Erickson, the ad agency. And, I went and watched a ton of them earlier today. And, I remember them all from being a little kid. And it was weird. They were, those of you who haven't seen them, the premise was you would get, a bunch of ex-athletes and then Mickey Spillane and Rodney Dangerfield and some other random pop cultural, icons of the time. Mm-hmm. and to sell Miller Lite and, you know, get in a big argument about tastes great and less filling at the end, Rodney would usually come in as the shimp who does something wrong to spoil everything.
Screw everything up for
everybody.
But it was
just such a weird, like, Bubba Smith and Dick Butkus and baseball players. And
I get all that,
Mickey
but
Spillane
Mickey
and,
Spillane.
I don't know. It was so strange.
Yeah.
But they were huge, and they really increased
the profile. He was the one who could score the weed for everybody else,
yeah, so
they let him. They let him on.
January 1984, if anyone remembers his hit rap single, Rappin' Rodney.
Have you guys heard this, really? It's something else.
It is, and it was a big hit, actually. It was a top 60 hit, which is pretty big.
Top 59, Chuck. Give it its due.
That means it was number 59.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was right behind Uptown Girl, and it was Rodney Dangerfield rapping about being old, which sounds really bizarre now. But, like, legitimate rappers at the time, like, say, the Sugar Hill Gang, were rapping about, like, having dinner at your friend's mom's house. So it wasn't that far off the mark for the time, you know?
It's like, be nice to your family. That's what raps were about at
the time.
The good old days. He was on The Simpsons, I think, a couple of times, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if he was on more than once.
I think he's on twice. But in 1996, he played Mr. Burns' illegitimate son, Herb, who got no regard at all. I wonder why they didn't say respect. Could they not?
I think they were just,
was it just a joke?
Messing around.
Okay.
Yeah, the man himself was there. I would have been surprised if he was like, look, guys, just one thing. I don't want to say respect.
Maybe not.
Can we just avoid that? I'm trying new things here. Trying to branch out. Which, actually, he did branch out. He was actually a really creative guy. He had a live Broadway show that ran for a couple of weeks in 1988 called, appropriately, Rodney Dangerfield Live on Broadway!
For a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
He wrote a romance novel called La Contessa, and if you Google the image for this,
it's disturbing.
Yeah, it's basically like your typical. It was like it's Fabio basically with a woman, except it's got Rodney Dangerfield's face on it.
And it's available on Audible.
Oh, is it really?
Yes, it is, with Rodney Dangerfield reading it.
No way.
I kid you not. Would I joke about what's on Audible?
Well, I looked up earlier to see if his autobiography was on there.
It is not. It's the only Rodney Dangerfield thing on there. It's awesome. Because it has the album art too. So you get that for free with the audiobook.
He wrote, I guess he didn't direct it, but he produced and wrote the movie Rover Dangerfield, the animated, classic about a dog who gets no respect. And then Mr. Oliver Stone called him up one day and said, I have this role for you in a movie called Natural Born Killers. And it's about this sadistic father who is molesting his daughter, raping his daughter. And I think you'd be perfect for it. And Rodney didn't get it at first. He was like, why do you want me for this kind of role?
He's like, you'll see.
Yeah. And did you guys see that, Natural Born Killers? You can get this scene on YouTube. It's when Oliver Stone did the phony sitcom. It's how they portrayed that part of the movie. So they have a laugh track, and it's really disturbing.
It's like at
to
least
watch.
Three layers of bizarre, right? So it's like Rodney Dangerfield is a sadistic, incestuous molester. But it's Rodney Dangerfield. So that's the weird part. And then there's a laugh track to just throw you off that little extra bit, you know? It's very jarring. It was pretty well done, but the notable thing about that is that Oliver Stone let Rodney Dangerfield rewrite all of his lines, and he got a lot of critical acclaim for it. Everybody was like, Rodney Dangerfield, we had no idea. And he's like, seriously?
If you go today and just Google, the Rodney Dangerfield of, you can find a whole list of things. He's such a cultural icon. That phrase itself has become a thing now. Mm-hmm. Like, Petite Sirah is the Rodney Dangerfield of California wines.
Yeah. Or, the Memphis, Tennessee City Council is the Rodney Dangerfield of local government.
Seriously. That's a thing. I even saw a guitar preamp. Was known as the Rodney Dangerfield of guitar preamps.
Yes. My favorite is Palladium is the Rodney Dangerfield of precious metals. Isn't that stupid?
We're not making this up.
So, Chuck, right about now, let's step back a second.
Mm-hmm.
press pause on this and have a beautiful little message break.
Agreed. Hey friends, if you've ever been in the market for a new home, you know home shopping can be a lot. There's so much you don't know and so much you need to know. Like, what are the neighborhoods like? What are the schools like? Who is the agent who knows the listing or neighborhood the best? And why can't all this information just be in one place?
Yeah, well, now it is, everybody, on Homes.com. They've got everything you need to know about the listing itself, but even better. They've got comprehensive neighborhood guides and detailed reports about local schools, and their agent directory helps you see the agent's current listings and sales history. Homes.com collaboration tools make it easier than ever to share all this information with your family.
It's a whole cul-de-sac of home shopping information all at your fingertips. Homes.com, we've done your homework.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So here's some more examples of the lack of respect. And here's sort of the thing. The irony is he got nothing but respect from his peers throughout his career. But outside of that, there was still just doses, peppered throughout his life and examples of times where he didn't get any respect. Like when he sued Star Magazine, they published a story about him being in Las Vegas and said he would drink, like tumblerfuls of vodka and smoke pot all day long and do cocaine, which was all completely true.
Probably dead on. But he knew that they couldn't prove it, so he sued them for libel. And the court ruled in his favor, right?
Yeah, so that's respect, right?
So they awarded him $1 for his damage to his reputation and $1 for personal distress.
Yeah.
And then the judge went,
"Yeah,
sorry, live stream people. I realize it's archived."
He did, he did get awarded $45,000 for presumed damages. And I did a little more research today on that. He
blew it all on coke and weed.
Apparently, Star Magazine showed that they didn't turn a profit, so he couldn't go after him for more. He couldn't appeal for more money.
Right.
So he tried to go after their parent company, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they said you didn't start the suit that way, so
they
can't
worded
change it
wrong.
Now, basically.
Right. Yeah. No respect.
And even in death, as we mentioned earlier, Rodney Dangerfield is dead. Why didn't I know that?
Oh, I have an example for you. Hold on, before he dies.
Okay.
He was on Howard Stern the year he died. And somebody,
did you watch that interview?
Yeah, I did.
Oh man, that's depressing.
He's 81. He's clearly like at death's door, but he still has his sense of humor about him. But somebody called in to Howard Stern and said, "Hey Rodney, it's Bob Hope. I'll see you in 15 minutes. And Howard Stern is like, "Well, that's not funny. Bob Hope is dead." So they were saying like that Bob Hope was calling from behind the grave and would see Rodney Dangerfield in 15 minutes. And if you can't get respect from a caller on the Howard Stern show, where can you get respect?
So it's actually in that interview, which I said is, it's like 45 minutes long and it's completely depressing. So don't go watch it. And not just because he was old, but Howard's trying to talk to him about his childhood and stuff. And
well, he had just written his autobiography and really just laid it all out there. Like, he'd alluded to the rough life that he'd had in interviews and stuff like that, but he published this book right before he died, and it was, I mean, it was rough.
Well, I think the saddest thing to me about his mom was that despite being completely neglected emotionally and getting no love at all as a child, he still wanted to be like a good kid, and he still worked to support her. And like, apparently came home and showed her his report card. He worked hard to get good grades. She wouldn't even look at it. She just like signed it without looking. And, that was the saddest part, is he still sort of defended her in that interview, like right before he was dying. And, and he made up with his dad before his dad died, apparently. Even though he never saw him, he said he forgave him for all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Really sad stuff, though. You want to hear some more jokes? Actually, why don't you tell him how he died?
Okay. Well, in this interview, in the same interview, he's telling Howard Stern. Howard Stern's like, he's about to go in for the should I pretend there's not a siren in the background? Or, he's going in for surgery, and Howard Stern asks him, like, are you afraid you're going to die? And he goes, you know what? Dying in surgery would be the best way to go. Like, I would go to, they drug me up, I'd go to sleep, and then I just wouldn't wake up. That's like as good as it gets, right?
Yeah.
So he goes in for this very surgery. He falls into a coma during surgery, almost there. And then he wakes up. Then he has a heart attack. Then he dies.
Yeah.
That's how Rodney Dangerfield went. After that life that he had, that's how he went. He was so close to going the way that he wanted to go. And no respect.
You want to hear no respect? A year after he died, CNN tried to get in touch with him to get his reaction about the passing of Johnny Carson.
And if you read his obituaries, a lot of them, a shocking amount, mentioned that he was well known for his role in The Scout. He wasn't in The Scout.
I got to the bottom of that.
Oh, lay it on me.
He was going to be in The Scout.
Okay.
The role was originally intended for him and Sam Kinison, and he didn't do it for unknown reasons, and it ended up going to Albert Brooks and Brendan Fraser.
Okay.
But it was one of those things, I think, where one of those internet neat things on the internet where someone prints something, then everyone else just copies and pastes it. So I think one person wrote that because everything else I saw was worded the exact same way.
Yeah.
Like list his movies as The Scout, which he was never in.
No, he wasn't.
No.
Thanks for looking into that, man.
Sure.
That's what you get when you hang with Chuck.
but he did find love again, in a situation in 1993 that everyone probably thought was like a typical gold digger. He was 61 years old. And he married a 30-year-old woman who was really hot, blonde, in L.A. But by all accounts, everything I looked into, it was not that.
No.
Like, she really, really loved him and was great for him, and they were super happy together, or as happy as he could be. And it turns out that it wasn't that kind of a deal after all, which made me feel good.
Yeah. Like, for example, when he died, she made sure that his funeral wasn't until 5 or dusk. Because he always asked her not to schedule any appointment for him before 5 p.m. So she made sure his funeral didn't come until after that.
And his funeral was a really big deal. Everyone basically came out in droves. His pallbearers included Jim Carrey, who he took Jim Carrey on the road for 2 years when he was a struggling comedian, and he opened for him in Vegas. And Jim Carrey was getting booed off the stage. Everyone hated him. And Rodney stuck by him for like a full 2 years. And Jim Carrey never forgot that. Chris Rock, Tim Allen, Larry David, George Carlin, Jay Leno, Adam Sandler, and then your boy, Michael Bolton.
Michael Bolton.
He was supposed to sing, wasn't he?
He was, but he was too choked up to sing at Rodney Dangerfield's funeral.
Right.
Apparently, they were really, really, really tight friends because Michael Bolton's song, Everybody's Crazy, was in Back to School, and I guess he parlayed that into a trip to the set where he got to meet Rodney Dangerfield, and they became friends for the rest of their life. So Michael Bolton was too sad to sing at Dangerfield's funeral, and you know everybody was disappointed.
I bet there were a couple of people there that were like, whew.
Yeah.
It's okay, Michael. We know you're upset.
You don't have to do this if you don't want. Everybody will understand. That's what they said to us before we went on.
So we're going to close this with a final nice little cherry on top about Rodney Dangerfield and sort of his outlook on his lack of respect with when it comes to the Academy of Motion Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Motion Picture Sciences?
Yes.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah. As you guys call it in L.A., the Academy.
Right. He applied for membership because he wanted to be in the Academy, and he had the credentials. He was in movies. And they said no.
No. You had to be in, like, at least 3 major roles.
Mm-hmm.
He had 13 under his belt by this time, including Natural Born Killers, for which he received a lot of critical praise, right? And they turned him down like jerks, right? He even got a letter from Malcolm McDowell.
Roddy McDowell.
Which one's Malcolm McDowell?
He's the good one.
Are they brothers?
I don't know. Are they? No relation?
But Roddy, wait, okay, was
Someone
Roddy,
just went, no.
Was Roddy, was, it was Malcolm McDowell.
Stop saying it.
Was Roddy McDowell in Clockwork Orange or Malcolm McDowell?
That was Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, well, okay, good, because I felt a lot better about this then.
Roddy McDowell was
in Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
So, okay, good. I'm glad that those two are separated in my mind, because I was like, I really liked him in Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
Good. Roddy McDowell, who everybody hates, wrote a letter to Rodney Dangerfield, this rejection letter that said that he had not had enough of the kind of roles that allow a performer to demonstrate a mastery of his craft.
Basically, you're just playing Rodney Dangerfield, and we all know it.
Even though he had all the credentials to get in, right? So Rodney Dangerfield, he's like, let's see, what year is it? 1995. What's new? What's on the horizon? Well, the internet. I think I'll build the world's first ever entertainment website. And he built his own website and realized that this would be a great place for his fans to come, like, vent their anger. And it was, as a matter of fact. Like, this guy, like, think about that. This is 1995.
Yeah.
And his fans came on and were like, to heck with the Academy, that kind of stuff. And the Academy actually relented and said, you're in, man.
Yeah.
You're in, Rodney. Come on in.
That's right. And what did he say?
Nope.
Yep. He said thanks, but no thanks. He still has a website, Rodney.com. And if you go to that, I just found this out earlier. There's a section called jokes and, had audio clips. I was like, oh, this is great. But it's not him. It's some dude reading like as bad as me.
Oh, really?
Just saying his little one-liners over and over. And it's not in front of people. It's like dead quiet. And it's just some dude saying his jokes. It's really weird.
I can't tell you how much I'd love the cover comedian idea.
Just, you know, how stealing from other comics is such a taboo. We just need to get out in front of
just
that.
Just own it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mix up a little like Mitch Hedberg and Rich Little and blow people's minds.
Do a little Stephen Wright there in the middle.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
I like it.
So that's Rodney Dangerfield, everybody. That's our show. If you wanted any more, you're SOL.
That's right.
Yeah, you can clap if you want. It's cool.
Hey, that was fun, right?
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, we had a great time, and big thanks to the LA Podcast Festival for having us out. And
yeah, please have us back. We'd love to.
Yeah, it was really cool. We got to see other shows, and we did our own and had a nice little crowd there. Very supportive, nice, kind people all the way around.
And look for the next LA Podcast Fest coming, I would imagine, next September. 2016.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll be there.
Yeah, keep your ears out for it. We'll mention it whether we are or not, because we're that kind of guys.
That's right. No listener mail for me, buddy.
No, but if you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can join us on Facebook.com/StuffYouShouldKnow. You can send us an email to StuffPodcast@HowStuffWorks.com. And as always, join us at our super awesome home on the web, StuffYouShouldKnow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
My psychiatrist said, you're crazy. Oh, wait, hold on. I already messed it up. No, that's right. My psychiatrist said I'm crazy. I told him I wanted a second opinion. He said, okay, you're ugly, too.
Yeah. He wrote that joke, man. Everybody knows that joke. It's a good joke. When my wife has sex, she screams, especially when I walk in on her.
Boy, he wrote a lot of jokes about his wife cheating on him.
Yeah.
Like hundreds and hundreds of jokes.
Because he wasn't married.
If it wasn't for pickpockets, I'd have no sex life at all.
Gross. The football team from my high school was tough. After they sacked the quarterback, they went after his family. That's a good, clean joke.
That's good.
It's nice.
What else we got here? I solved my drinking problem. I joined AA. I mean, I still drink. I just use a different name.
I'm getting old. At my age, shooting up means using an enema bag.
I think there's one more about a dog that I... Oh, yeah. What a dog I got. What a dog. His favorite bone is in my arm.
I think that's it for me.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. I want to say that I have another one hiding in here somewhere, but I can't find it.
All right.
Well, yeah.
Go to the YouTube, folks.
Yeah, make sure you look up Iron Man versus Dirty Dancing. You will love it.
Anything else?
No, that's it.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.
See you soon. You guys.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait!
Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/power safely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.